Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
You learn about kind of the human spirit by seeing the forces in nature and how they work. And it's not all rainbows and butterflies. That's part of nature. But there's also the lightning strike, and there's also the whirlwind.
Hi, I'm Rosie Acosta. I'm a meditation teacher, speaker, and author of You Are Radically Loved, A Healing Journey to Self-Love. Look, I grew up in East Los Angeles during the 92 LA riots, and it set me on a troubled path. I didn't grow up with mentors in my life, so I turned to reading as many books as I possibly could to learn about the purpose of life. In my journey, I found that having these conversations gave me life, and I decided I wanted to create a place where I could share these conversations with my community. So come have a sit with me as we learn about, well, everything. Hi, friends. Welcome to the Radically Loved podcast and to this very special rerun episode with my very dear friend, Kiara Alegria Hudes. She wrote one of my favorite books of all time called My Broken Language. And in this conversation, we discuss her intention behind writing the story and all of the lessons she learned along the way on this writing journey. She is absolutely one of my most favorite human beings on the planet. She is so deep, so heart-centered, and an incredibly talented writer and playwright. I'm so excited to share this conversation with you all again. As you know, I'm taking a little bit of a hiatus, but we will be back. I already miss you so much. Stay tuned for the latest happenings. You can sign up on my newsletter using the link in the show notes, or you can just go to radicallyloved.com. You can also check out my episodes on Radio Headspace and also guest hosting Dear Headspace, all Headspace Studio podcast. Studios, plural? I think it's plural. I think it's plural. But anyway, I hope you enjoy this conversation. I miss you all so much, and I can't wait to hear what you thought. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Radically Loved. I am joined by a very special guest. And, you know, I say that because every guest is special, but our guest today is probably a career highlight for me. So thank you, Kiara, for being here today.
That's so kind. It's my pleasure.
It truly is. We were just chatting a little bit before we started, but your writing just across the board has really created so much opportunity and inspiration for Latinos everywhere, Hispanic people, Spanish-speaking people. I have felt so encouraged and seen by your work. And it's one of those things that I admire people that are telling the types of stories that you tell, because I feel like mine matters. And so I want to say thank you for that, first of all. And I want to welcome you to the show. I'm excited to have this conversation with you.
Thank you. Your story does matter. I mean, that's clear from, you know, the people that are listening to the podcast, even when you're interviewing people, we feel your story and you kind of staking your claim with your story, and you're going to have a book soon. So we'll get to know more of your story through that.
Yes. And it was a very daunting experience for me. You know, one of the things that I've always wanted to ask you, sometimes I talk to you, you know, especially as I read your books, I'm like, I wonder what happened here. I wonder how this is different. Mm-hmm. And when she mm-hmm. wrote her first play, like now she's writing this memoir, what was the different, you know, what was the energy between the two? Because I know that with your playwriting, you talk about them being fictional characters, right? You say these are fictional characters that are mm-hmm. obviously related to maybe similar stories that you knew personally, but writing a memoir was obviously different than writing a play, I would imagine. So the book that really inspired me the most, especially while I was writing mine, was your memoir, My Broken Language. So can you tell us a little bit more about what the energy was like writing this story? And if for the people that are watching this or listening to this, maybe just like a brief description of what that story is about, what your memoir is about.
So it's called My Broken Language, and it's a memoir of my youth. So my early childhood up through, I would say, the moment in my 20s when I became a woman, when I became an adult, you know, when I quote unquote came of age. And it's called My Broken Language because I was saturated in and surrounded by many different languages throughout my life. Spanish, English, and the hybrid form Spanglish. I was a musician, and so there were many different musical vocabularies that were part of my upbringing, from my aunt's rock and roll music and classical music to my mother's bata drumming. There were also a lot of spiritual languages surrounding me growing up. My mother, I got a front row seat at her path towards becoming a Lukumi priestess, towards becoming a santera, crowned in Changong. And I also went to Quaker meetings. So there were so many different languages around me. I saw the visual languages of her Afro-Caribbean altars in our living room, but I also would go to the Philadelphia Art Museum and see the visual languages of Western modern art, like Marcel Duchamp. And out of all those different languages, I had to decide how I wanted to speak. And I did want to speak. All my life, I wanted to.
And that you did in ways that we've been able to enjoy in the stories that you tell. I found so many similarities just in your story. You know, you talk about sort of growing up on two different sides of the tracks, right? Like having the two different experiences mm-hmm. with your parents. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was like?
Yes, well, I'm a mix. My background is mixed. So my father is a white Jewish man from Long Island. My mother is a brown Boricua woman from a large, diverse family, racially family, but mostly brown Boricua women. Actually, it's a very matriarchal family. And so once my parents separated when I was a very young age, my life split in two. I was mostly raised by my mom and my stepfather, who's also a Boricua man, in Philly, but I did still go visit my father, and that was out in the main line, which is a far more white area, and it's more affluent too. So I had this very split brain, and I didn't understand why the brown Boricua family, I saw their reality held up against this kind of American dream suburbia. And it started to irk me big time as a child. There were these like wonderful magical secrets that I refer to them in the book as the Perez women, because it's the Perez family. My grandmother was Obdulia, or as we called her, Abuela Julia Perez. And they did have these magical secrets. They could dance in the midst of horrific loss in a way that was cathartic. And it was awesome to me to see this. You know, I remember, you know, these were war on drugs times. These were HIV AIDS times. And there was so much loss. And it was a lot of young, you know, or untimely death. And it hit close to home. And yet you pop in the tape, we hear about Chata Rosa and the dance elevates to such an ecstatic place of release. It was really gorgeous. And I was like, okay, my family out in the suburbs, they don't have that special sauce. But damn, they got like clean streets and, you know, and manicured lawns. And what's going on here? What is this American project that is now my life?
Yeah. God, that is where I really felt my story live in literature. I really felt that same experience in that, because obviously, like growing up in East LA during the LA riots in this very much immigrant family neighborhood hub in East LA, and seeing the chaos that gang violence was inciting during this time. I mean, they call it, you know, now they look back and they call it the decade of death. You know, it was just, there was a lot of just unsupervised children, because all the families, all the parents worked. And so they grew up to be adolescents and they were causing havoc, right? It's sort of this disenfranchised youth experience that was causing that. Yeah, like the chaos that was happening all around us. Meanwhile, my abuelita would host these rosarios, you know, these prayer circles, mm-hmm. and have these women come together. And I sort of learned the importance of ritual, the importance of prayer. And as you're saying, like the sort of celebration, and in the midst of going through these really scary, horrific things, there was still so much love and so much grounding in these like family traditions and pulling from faith and believing in spirituality and being able to stay grounded in the sense of, okay, even though this is happening externally, there is still something very much present that is grounding you on this earth, in this plane, even though part of my story, right, is the cognitive dissonance of, okay, but if all of this is real, why is all this bad stuff happening? Mm-hmm. Right. So mm-hmm. I felt that in your realization of, okay, wait, why is this family here doing this? And why is this then facade look different from the facade of where the people that I love as well are, right? Does that make sense?
Well, you know, can we talk about this notion of chaos for a second?
Yes.
I could feel that there was something in the kind of physical design and landscape and architecture of the suburbs that was really, even as a child, I'm talking 7 years old, 8 years old, there was something about it that was, in a false way, trying to contain a chaos, mm-hmm. trying to mask a chaos that is a natural component of life. You know, I don't wish chaos or suffering on anybody. However, both of those things do bring one closer to life's essence, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, these moments when, for instance, in the book's plot covers four moments when, for lack of a better word, I experienced something like a possession and really lost myself. And these are moments of storytelling and writing in my life. And what happened in those moments was that I was able to ride the chaos of life in a way that was created like tremendous flow and power. I was able to harness the chaos that was around me and true to life, as opposed to this kind of suburban approach of the more order we create, the less chaos exists. I'm not sure that that actually is how the universe works, you know?
Right.
So I was very distraught about my family's suffering in those times, about the losses, the struggles. And yet it felt like there was a more honest embodiment of the life and death questions that humanity deals with every day. It didn't feel like we had, honestly, we didn't have the bandwidth to be constructing facades. We had to deal with life and death every day, you know? And prayer was certainly part of that. You know, our cooking together, it was very physical, you know? Mm-hmm. The churches, yeah, there were churches that we went to, but our bodies were our churches. You know, our bodies were the liturgical flesh and blood. You know, we had migrated so far in Puerto Rico, we migrated from place to place. Then we migrated to the Bronx and we migrated to Philadelphia. So our church came with us, our nature came with us. And we did, even though there was more pain and suffering, it also felt like there was more honest living. And I think that the thing about my coming of age as a child is the truth is, living that honestly scared the crap out of me.
Yeah.
I wanted life to feel like the suburbs, but I knew life isn't like that.
Yeah. Yeah. But that to me is the meat of your story. And that's where I'm saying, like, I really felt myself reflected in that, because it's the truth. It's the truth of life. That is the actual reality. We have this, I'm just saying, generally people that don't experience the chaos or death in that way, it's almost like this thing that doesn't exist, right? Whereas opposed to you growing up having to grapple with death and illness, right? And having these spiritual awakenings in your life created this deeper understanding of how we move around and how we move about in the world, that it's not all rainbows and butterflies, right? And I hear that sometimes whenever I talk in this way, that people say that I sound, you know, cynical in a way, but I don't think it's cynical at all. I think it's true. I think it's the reality of life. And I feel like a lot of Hispanic cultures, death is such a prevalent cornerstone to our living, our ability to live, right? My dad is always saying, like, in Spanish, oh, I'm not going to be here forever. Like, come visit me now that I'm alive, because when I'm dead, you know, you're mm-hmm. not going to, you know, I don't want you crying at my funeral. Like, come see me now that I'm here. And in a way, yeah, it's like, it's not really, it's a joke, but it's not a joke, because it just reminds me of the prevalence that impermanence is a big constant in our daily life.
And mess and muck and mud. It's part of the cycle of life, right? So yeah, there's the rainbows and butterflies approach. It's like arts and crafts versus a work of magnificent chaotic art, right? Both of those are valid. But if you can never get to that ecstasy, the rainbows and butterflies, the arts and crafts, it's not enough. It's not a fully saturated experience. And so I was scared. I was scared to be that saturated an experience. And I would watch it with a remove. I would watch the dance party at Abuela's house. I would watch the grief at the funerals. And I was terrified of that. Terrified. Are you kidding me? And I was even terrified to dance with my cousins, because they could move in a way that was real and immediate. Mm. And I was not sure that I could move that way. I wanted to live that immediately. And through the writing, I was able to tap into that. I wasn't trying to pretend. I wasn't trying to put order on thing. I was trying to harness, you know, the energy of life that's out there that can be calm and can be a tsunami. These are all things reflected in nature, you know?
Yeah.
This is why I think that I learned a lot of this from my mother, watching her path to be crowned as a priestess, because the Orisha are essentially source energy. It's natural energy. And so you learn about kind of the human spirit by seeing the forces in nature and how they work. And it's not all rainbows and butterflies. That's part of nature. But there's also the lightning strike, and there's also the, you know, the whirlwind.
Yeah. What was it like for you to go into your life from that first person perspective and have to sort of examine your actual life, as opposed to maybe pulling creative moments from your family members to create a play, or, you know, to write an art piece, as I like to call it? What was it like for you to go into that, into this world, the world of memoir, writing your story? I know that you, maybe if I'm correct from what I remember, you started writing it at the end of 2019 or 2020?
Yeah, 2019, yeah.
And so were you done by the time the pandemic happened, or?
Yes, pretty much. I was doing some like copy editing and stuff during that time. Yeah. You know, one of the things that I think a lot of people going into memoir get nervous about is memory and accuracy, right? Because you hear this all the time. And I was one of the people saying it. I don't remember anything. And literally, I don't remember. Because my parents separated, I went to so many schools growing up. I don't remember all of them. I don't remember who my kindergarten teacher was, second, third. I don't know any of that. I don't know where I went to school from age. I can't remember the building, which town. Was I in the suburbs? Was I in the city? I don't know. So I thought, well, how can someone who doesn't know where they were from kindergarten through, you know, I remember sixth grade. That's where it kind of starts. How can you possibly write a memoir? But the truth is, we do remember. Our bodies, I remember the feeling of that time, of that moment. I remember this feeling, you know, and that is a form of memory. It's, you know, I'm not trying to construct a timeline of events. I'm trying to tell a story about growth. So what I discovered was that I remembered a lot more than I gave myself credit for, just because I don't remember who my third grade teacher is or something, you know. But it took process and it took a lot of focus and really paying attention to what those memories were and owning them. When I started the book, it was right around the time I started, I went to a new therapist and I said to her, well, I'm here because these cousins of mine who were in their 20s, I was very close with them and they all passed away, you know, when I was an adolescent and I never cried over them. And yet I thought about them every day and it affected everything in my life. So why did I not cry about them? And I think that the book was a process for me to understand how disembodied I had become from my own life and my loved ones. And so the process was peeling back a lot of layers, which I've heard you talk about on this show before, very investigative into the self. Very investigative. And the other thing is I'm used to writing about my family members and I do approach that with a tenderness and a care. I'm very protective of them. You know, if someone comes at you, it's one thing. Okay, fine, whatever. If someone comes at your loved one, it's like, let's go. No, that's not happening. So I was very protective, always writing about my loved ones. When I wrote about myself, I tried to be a little harder on myself, be a little more critical about myself. And I did write some things that were very, for me, ugly and painful to admit, thoughts I had, silences I had participated in, you know, internalized racism, internalized sexism, internalized ageism, even though the book is in some ways a defense of large brown bodies, because I come from a family of big plus size women, also internalized fat phobia that still existed in there. That I was wrestling with. So it was hard to be honest about those things.
Yeah. I just want to know the process of what it was like for you to get that final copy of it. It's done. My Broken Language is done. And you have to give it one more read through. What was it like to read it through when it was, I'm going to say done, because I've heard interviews where you talk about this before. It's like, is it ever really done? And I want to go into that topic here in a minute, but what was it like for you to read it from beginning to end when it was complete?
I don't know if have I ever read it. You know, when I read it from beginning to end was when I did the audiobook.
Oh, which I also got, by the way. It's so good. If you're listening to this, the link is in the show notes. I'm going to repeat this, but you read it, right?
Yeah.
So Kiara reads it. Please, if you're an audiobook person, listen to it. It's so good. Go ahead.
Thank you. To read it like that, out loud in the audiobook, it was challenging. I had a real appreciation for all the actors who have brought my work to life over my 20-year career as a playwright. And it put me right back there. Oh my gosh, there was this one scene in, I think the year is 1995 at that point. And I'm in high school, I'm in government and politics class at Central High School in Philadelphia. And the topic of the day was welfare queens, right? This is how we referred to our sisters, our aunts, this is how our nation referred to our sisters and aunts. This is how the headline news referred to the matriarchs of our family, welfare queens. And I had not heard the phrase before. So when that phrase got dropped in government and politics class, you know, it's like my spidey sense went up. I was like, what? What are you talking about? And it really blew my mind. The conservative boys in the class were like, yeah, you know, they have more babies to get a bigger welfare check. And I knew exactly which cousin of mine they were talking about. And I was, it was a real aw hells no moment for me, because I was like, no, I know who you're talking about. And you better not look me in the eye and say, that's why she had a child, you know, or, you know, a lot of children. And I really lost my cool. And reading that and remembering that, I mean, it took me right back there. I felt like that teenager freaking out in, you know, in government and politics class again. So yeah, it was wild. It was like a time machine.
Yeah. Oh my God, so good. I'm like, this is just, yeah, one of the reasons why, as you know, I read your story and I'm just like, oh, I know exactly what that is like. It reminded me of the first time I experienced something similar with my abuelita. Like, my abuelita was the one that raised us because both my parents worked, and we lived in a house with, we lived in a two-bedroom apartment with seven people, you know, the whole family lived there in East LA. And so going to the grocery store with my abuelita, and we were in line at the grocery store, and the guy checking us out, the teller, what is he called? The
cashier.
Cashier, yes. I'm like, what is this person? They give money, they get the money. The cashier was talking to an older gentleman right before my abuelita was there, and said something like, oh, they were having a conversation. We're just sitting there waiting. And the cashier kind of motioned like, oh, I've got to kind of speed it up. Somebody's behind you. And then he looks over and he goes, oh, those dirty Mexicans, you can continue the conversation with me. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, like, I asked my abuelita, I'm like, ¿quién es? You know, and I asked her in Spanish, like, who are dirty Mexicans? What is a dirty Mexican is what I asked her. Mm-hmm. And then she just kept telling me to like, be quiet, like, don't say anything. And I just was so confused. Like, what, why is he saying that? I don't understand. And I'm just like looking at myself, like, am I dirty? I don't understand. Like, what does this mean? And when we came back home, I asked, when my dad came home, my dad would come home before my mom. And I said, hey, this man at the grocery store called us a dirty Mexican. What is that? And he tried to explain it in a very sort of like loving experience for me, because he obviously saw that I didn't understand what racism was at that age. But I know that what this man had said, I didn't like it. And it made my grandma sad. Yeah. And it made me feel very angry, you know? And just at that age, you begin to understand, oh, the way I look, there's something wrong with the way I look. Even though my sister and I mean, we're American, right? But we're Hispanic, like, we're Mexican people, you know? Like, my dad explained the situation where he said, you know, sometimes people are not going to like you because of what you look like and where you come from. And you have to remember that that's okay, and it's their loss. And you have to just remember that you are who you are, and you always have to be proud of that. Oh my God, I could get emotional, but
yeah,
all I could think is him telling me stories of him growing up in this little shanty town in Mexico and going to school with no shoes because they didn't have any shoes. And he would just go to school with no shoes, and his journey to coming to the US and the struggles of that. And for me to stand there with my grandmother and have somebody say that, it wasn't just the words, right? Like, there's a beautiful quote you say in the beginning of the book, like right when you open, and I wish I had it in front of me so I can say, you talk about the power of words. And
Dr. Moreno Vega's quote. Yeah. So that quote is from Dr. Marta Moreno Vega, who is a wonderful scholar and practitioner and cultural creator within the Afro-Caribbean community, within the Afro-Boricua community, and within the Lucumí tradition. And her books are phenomenal. I especially recommend the book Altar of My Soul. And the quote that starts the book off is from her. And it says that words carry power, and words have their own ache.
I love that. So one of my biggest issues when I started running, when I started my career training for marathons and just continuing my love for running, was always the issue of dehydration. I remember specifically during one of our 10-mile training runs, I had the absolute worst headache. I had so much fatigue, and my coach basically determined that I had zero hydration because, well, let's be honest, I wasn't hydrating properly. Also, while running or doing any strenuous workout, you lose a lot of electrolytes. Luckily, my friends over at Element provided the most epic product for us to use. Even if you're not an athlete, it's so important to replenish our electrolytes. This can be after having even a few glasses of wine, or after you work out, or just if you have an active lifestyle. Element, spelled L-M-N-T, is a tasty electrolyte drink mixed with everything you need and nothing that you don't, which means lots of salt with no sugar. Element is perfectly formulated to help anyone with their electrolyte needs, and it's perfectly suited for anyone who follows keto, low carb, or paleo diet. I mean, truly, the benefits are endless. When you sweat, the primary electrolyte lost is sodium, and athletes can lose up to 7 grams per day. When sodium is not replaced, it's common to experience muscle cramps and fatigue. Right now, Element is offering my listeners a free sample pack with any purchase. That's 8 single serving packets free with any Element order. This is a great way to try all 8 flavors or share Element with a salty friend. Get yours at drinkelement.com/Rosie. The deal is it's only available through my link. So go to drinkelement.com/Rosie. Also, you can try it totally risk-free. If you don't like it, they will give you your money back, no questions asked. You have nothing to lose. So check it out today. That's drinkelement.com/Rosie. drinkelement.com/Rosie. This deal is only available through my link. You can also get the link in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for being a supporter of the show. And so, yeah, just coming back to, again, just reading your story and feeling seen, I think part of the, I don't want to say struggle, but I think some of the obstacles that I faced growing up, especially in a world that I'm in now, in the world of spirituality or in the world of connection and radical love, and this sort of path that I took on after, you know, growing up in an environment like that, getting in trouble with the law, mm-hmm. you know, getting arrested, and that kind of set me off on this path, is, was I going to end up to be a product of my socioeconomic inheritance, or was I to change my life and do something else? There's the, again, not feeling like you fit in anywhere, because, you know, you're growing up and the kids that are from other countries, like, you're not, for me, it's like you weren't from Mexico, so I wasn't Mexican, so I mm-hmm. couldn't be part of like my Mexican friends because I was American, right? And then we're also not white, so it's like, you know, you're, everybody's so cliquey, and you can't really hang out with your white friends because you're like, you're not white, right? So you're left in this sort of in-betweener space where you also go home and watch Spanish news and Spanish TV, but you're also watching like The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and you're watching like different yeah. worlds, and, you know, Silver Spoons, and you're watching all these shows. There's this, I don't know how to describe it, but I felt, again, very seen in your story, because I felt like, oh, this is the place that I was looking for. This is the place that felt, okay, it's the in-between space where, instead of feeling like I need to be this or that, I realize I can be all of it, and I am all of it, and that's perfect.
It's right? freedom. It's like having a hall pass all the time that nobody knows about, because you literally kind of can't be confined in one space. For me, especially speaking as like biracial, you know, interfaith, like all of these things, there's just no box that's 100% accurate. And I think people who aren't biracial also feel this about, you know, questions of identity and labeling, you know, that there aren't boxes where that are 100% accurate. And it's actually in the, like, the fluid motion between them and the straddling of them that, you know, I did find freedom there. I did find freedom there. I was like, freedom to be countercultural, freedom to not fit in. That is a big freedom, especially, I mean, I think about this in middle school, the way the girls would look at their bodies and the pressure they clearly felt to dress a certain way, to look a certain way. I did not feel that. It was, I had freedom to not fit in. It was very liberating. I appreciated that, even if it meant that I didn't fit in sometimes, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That, I love that. There's so much power in that freedom. One of the things that I was reminded of too, when I was reading, was, I guess my experience of that was being in an environment, there was a lot of gang violence, and if you wore a certain color, it was not good in a certain neighborhood. So you had to be careful with going from point A to point B because you're traveling, you know, through certain neighborhoods. So my remedy to that was, oh, I'll just be like a punk rock kid. You know, I'll just wear black all the time because it's safe. And, you know, I don't have to worry about fitting in anywhere. I don't have to choose. And it gave me a sense of individuality and really feeling into, oh, I'm doing this to be safe, but I actually like not having to make a choice. You know, it feels nice to be able to have that, yeah, that freedom to just be this person. There's another question. God, you said something and I'm like, oh, I want to come back to that. Now I'm trying to remember what you said. There was like so much was said. In regard to your belief system now, where are you in your spiritual journey, would you say, today?
Today is a very specific response for that for me. I do think more and more that, you know, the faith I carry is earth-based and body-based. That's just the lineage I inherit. You know, my ancestors were farmers in Puerto Rico. They passed on their knowledge of indigenous science and of the land. My mother and my aunts took that knowledge to places where there was much less land, like North Philly, and yet somehow created gardens in, you know, places of vast stretches of concrete and light, you know? So I inherit these kind of earthbound and body-bound spiritual lineages. And what just happened is, this is why I am excited to talk to you this week in particular, is that a new baby just came into our family. And so I'm the oldest sibling. So I had my babies first. My babies are not babies anymore. And when you have your own children, you know, that's a zone. That's a whole space you're in. It's very particular. But when you're at the side of a delivering woman, especially if she's, you know, a sister, it's a whole different energy and you see it in a different way. So I got to get in the car and drive down the New Jersey Turnpike, you know, when the contractions were 6 minutes apart, we're timing them on Zoom and, or on FaceTime. And I said, I'm getting in the car, I'm coming down, I'm still going to make it in time. And to help, you know, my loved one labor, to help her bring that newborn home. You know, this was the church again. This was the land again. This was the farm. Our plot of land is in a different location now. It's in our bodies here. It's in Philadelphia. It's, you know, bookended on the New Jersey Turnpike, but we still have it. We still got it. And it was very sacred. So I felt really grateful to be given that moment to rise into.
Yes. Thank you so much for sharing that. It's like our bodies have become this place of worship now, right? So I wanted to ask you, with regard to where we are in our society, how there are a lot of people that are sick that maybe neglect their bodies and don't really focus on their physical form as much as maybe they should. I know it's a big topic in communities of color, right? Where diabetes is higher in these communities, heart disease. And I feel that we've become less of a movement society over the last, I don't know, I would say maybe like 20 years, where it feels like now technology, which has, yes, helped us very much, it's created a more sedentary experience, right? We're watching TV, we're on our computers, we're working from home, we're playing video games, you know, whatever it might be. Do you think that that has anything to do with why mental illness is at an all-time high?
Oh, wow. I don't have the expertise really to weigh in on that. But I do think that one of the ills of American society is it's a very disembodied nation. You know, and that's less a comment on like health concerns. I don't feel that I have the authority or the knowledge to really weigh in on that, but it is an existential and a spiritual and a philosophical observation, you know, that to us, the intellect reigns supreme, the thought, the rationality, hopefully, I mean, maybe some might argue that, maybe I'm arguing with myself, but you know, it's a very mind driven and in mind, there's status, you know, and all of these things. And it's just like, well, where's the body? Where's the spirit? Where's the energy? It's very disembodied. And I find that tremendously unhealthy. This is why it was exhilarating to be in a situation this week where there is only body and spirit.
Yeah.
You know, and the amount of presence required to simply ride the wave of one contraction, rest for 2 minutes, and then mount the wave of the next contraction. It requires you just shed all of those taboos and inhibitions about, you know, well, the body ain't where it's at. You know, what you got to say? What argument do you have? Okay, fine, put that aside. It was very liberating and healing for me. You know, the other thing that it brought to mind, and you did ask about health, and this is a little bit answering question A with creating my own question here, but my sister was telling me about her experience at a birth center that she went to. And she said it was a completely 100% consent-based experience. And I am very familiar with the notion of consent when it comes to sexual interactions and intimacy. But I actually, having delivered 2 children, was completely unfamiliar with the notion of consent when it comes to medical practice. And it really blew my mind. And I thought, you know, she said every time the midwives or the nurse practitioners would do something as simple as take her blood pressure, they would say what they were doing first and ask if it was okay. And I had 2 very high medical intervention deliveries, which were unpleasant experiences. They were really hard. And very intense things were done to my body, not only without consent, without even telling me what was happening. And it hurt and it was rushed and so this notion of consent, I think at a time when clearly the American public with vaccinations and all this stuff, there's still a lot of distrust and questioning around the medical establishment. You know, I was like, this notion of consent in mainstream medicine, I think is one that I understand now and that maybe should be paid more attention to.
Wow. Yeah, I 100% agree with you. I think that it's interesting that you say that because it's something that I hadn't thought about until even the last couple of months. You know, I mentioned to you that Tori, my partner, and I had gone through COVID and that was really, really difficult for us. And just having that experience, having to go to the hospital 2 different times because there was like some situation with oxygen levels. For Tori and for me, I was having major debilitating panic attacks that I hadn't had since I was a teenager.
Wow. Wow.
And both were really bizarre experiences, but having nurses and doctors come in and ask, you know, is this okay? I'm going to do this now, was really interesting because I had another set of friends that had one of them actually had one of their parents passed away from COVID. And the other parent was also hospitalized and they ended up intubating him without his, there was like some consent thing that it was like, what the process they were doing, they weren't telling him what he was doing. He didn't speak English. So it was a very sort of violating experience is the way that he described it. He said, I felt very like disregarded, like nobody asked me or told me what they were doing to me. And they just started putting things and wow. injecting me with things. And it just felt like I just wanted to know what they were doing. So yeah, I mean, I think it's so, I think we just definitely undervalue not only our own voice, the power of our voice, the power of our ability to ask questions and the power of our physical body. I mean, you were talking about the dancing and the shaking and being able to express and exercise, right? Like an exorcism, like you're literally exercising your body. And I believe that we're able to process this. I don't remember exactly the study of, I remember now. The name of the book is called Waking the Tiger. And it's by, please somebody correct me if I'm wrong, I'll just edit the right answer in here. But I believe it's Peter Levine, Dr. Peter Levine. The name of the book is called Waking the Tiger. And he talks about the study of how anger moves through the body. And the study that they're observing ducks in this pond. And they see these two ducks come together and then they have a little spat. They start kind of like fighting. And then they see both these ducks move away from each other. And then they open and extend their wings and then they shake them out. And then they self-regulate and move back. And it's, you know, nobody's... holding the receipts saying, oh, well, an hour ago you came at me and, you know, it's not like the duck isn't going to go back to the same duck and tell them why they now resent them and why they're going to withhold love from them. But we somehow allow all those emotions to get locked in our bodies. And the reason why I'm saying that is because I want to tie it into the idea of embodiment and movement and what you're saying about how we are a very disembodied society. I mean, even social media is a disembodied way of connecting with others.
Oh, yes.
Right? And how that affects us is something that we don't know. I mean, for me, the big thing, and again, like, yeah, I'm not an expert. Kara's not in here saying that she's a mental health expert or like a doctor. But you are very knowledgeable. And let's be honest, you're an award-winning writer. I mean, like, you know something about something, right? Like, let's give credit where credit is due. I think about all of the creative energies that we can harness and how that is connected to our ability to embody all of those gifts, to embody our skills, to embody our emotions, to embody our lives. And this is the difference, right? Somebody that's disembodied is maybe not going to feel as connected to their life than somebody who is embodied, right?
Yeah. You know, I think that when we are very physical, it's a form of processing. You know, you're talking about social media and writers know more than anyone how inadequate words are, really, in the face of human accomplishment and torment and heart and spirit, right? But a lot of social media reduces our exchanges and our relationships to words, which I do contend, though I'm in the business of words, they're really, really inadequate. And, you know, they don't in any way, they supplement but don't replace just vibing with someone, right? The vibe, the spirit, the energy, the flow, the chill. Like, you know, have you ever had that kind of friend that you can literally be like quiet with for half an hour? You know, that's real. That's real. And then you have the friend that you can laugh like a dummy with for, you know, and cackle with, right? These are not words. These are modes of being in the world. And when you can do that alone, or you can be in that space with someone else, creating a mode of being together, you know? So I did feel as a child, because my mother's spiritual practice was Afro-Caribbean as a priestess of Lukumi, there's a lot of drum involved. And I started to feel the connection at some point between what was happening with the drum, with the bata, which is an orisha, and what was happening with my cousins dancing so ecstatically and full-bodied. What was happening with the grief? I thought our voice, the drum is a voice. We have a drum inside us. That is our voice. That is our heart. These things are connected. These are the sacred practices of being alive, being an animal, having a flesh and blood body as part of our existence, you know? And then it made sense to me. I started to understand who we were in a bigger context, you know, that our body was part of the church. Our body was like the physical manifestation of the drum, but then the reverberation and sound is that's the vibration that comes from the physical manifestation. It was very exciting to me to make these connections, though they were intense. It was like a lot of God around me a lot of the time as a kid. And also, I didn't have those powers. I didn't have the power of dance, nor did I have the power that my mother had, which was, she was deeply connected with the spirit world in a way, in an uncommon way. I saw amazing things happen. You know, the dead would come and announce themselves to her, and she would see this. She would see before people passed away. So to be around this tremendous physical power and to not have it, I had a front row seat at a pretty damn good show growing up, you know, but then the question comes at a certain point, well, what are you going to do with it, Kiara?
Yeah. It's so good. I mean, I want to, I feel like we're just starting the conversation. I want to be respectful of your time. And I just feel like that is a great place to complete this conversation, even though I feel like it's an opening to continue the conversation. But I'm so grateful for you and for the work that you do and for sharing your experiences with us. And thank you for creating works of art that reflect people like me's experience, because it makes us feel like we matter and like our stories are important. Mm-hmm. So thank you for doing that.
Sure, truly.
That being said, I have one final question to ask you that I ask all of my guests. But before I do that, where can people learn more? Where can they go for more information about you?
Well, my book is for sale at all the bookstores, at wherever you want to get the books. My website is kiara.com, and that talks about, some people have heard of my plays, some people have heard of my book, but if you want to get a broader sense of my kind of multi-writer path, it's kiara.com, Q-U-I-A-R-A.com.
We will add all of those links in the show notes. So if you're watching this video on YouTube, it'll be in the description below. If you're listening to this, wherever you get your podcast, it'll be in the info button and you can connect with Kiara there. Do you do social media at all? I know you have a presence.
Yeah, I'm on Instagram. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's, oh boy, I don't remember my handle.
We'll put it in the show notes, everybody. We'll look at it. We'll put it in the show notes so you can check it there. So the final question, I created this podcast as a way to just create essentially a community, a support system to have people feel supported. And the whole idea of why I started Radically Loved was the idea that we are radically loved and supported by God's source, whatever you believe, whatever power, nature, that the universe works for us, not against us. Mm-hmm. And so the final question to you, Kiara, is how do you feel radically loved?
Many different ways. And it's such a gift, all of those different ways. Right now, I feel radically loved when I'm able to accept real help and support being offered from others. Not a little favor here. I'm talking real support, and I can just accept it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for being here. Thank you for spending time with us. And as I said, I'm so beyond grateful for you, for everything that you do, all of your work. And I'm looking forward to continue to see more. No pressure. Thank you so much for being here. And To you, the listener, thank you so much for listening. Please remember to share this with anybody who you think would gain value from this conversation. We appreciate you and we radically love you. Thank you so much for listening to the Radically Loved podcast. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Facebook at Radically Loved Rosie, on Instagram at Rosie Acosta, and Twitter at Rosie Acosta. By the way, this is original music by DJ Taz Rashid. You can follow DJ Taz on Spotify and check out the best music for yoga and meditation. This has been a Mod Pod Studio production. Check them out at www.modpodstudio.com.
Heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps.
In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic.
Keep your eyes on the road.
Hop on Moto Casino.
Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly.
Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.